With endorsements from President Donald Trump and the Ohio Republican Party, Vivek Ramaswamy would appear to have his party's nomination for governor locked up. But could another candidate enter the race? I'm Lucy May. Today on Cincinnati Edition, the state of the Ohio gubernatorial race. Then, preliminary autopsy results in the death of Ryan Hinton. And are we closer to a decades-in-the-making Brent Spence Bridge project? Joining me now to kick off the news review today are Ohio Public Media, State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And Signal Ohio state government and politics reporter Andrew Tobias. Thanks for being here, Andrew.
Happy to do it.
Andrew, catch us up on Vivek Ramaswamy's campaign to become Ohio's next governor. Tell us about this state GOP endorsement.
Yeah, I believe it was a couple of weeks ago now, but the Ohio Republican Party's Central Committee has a rule that if it wants to endorse in a race where there's no incumbent, two-thirds of the committee have to do it. So, and there are 66 people on the committee, so it's actually kind of a lot of people that you have to get to agree on something. So there is a mechanic to it. And it's just notable. They met a couple of weeks ago, and two-thirds of them did indeed vote to issue an endorsement. And then once that question was out of the way, because there are some members of the committee who maybe have principled oppositions to, you know, should the party issue an endorsement in a race where it's, you know, the filing deadline is nearly a year away. So why don't we just let the process play out? That question was settled. And then Ramaswamy got the endorsement really easily. And it's a show of strength, I think, for him as a candidate, the degree to which he's locked up kind of the support within the Republican Party.
What was the vote, Andrew?
I forget the number off the top of my head, but it was several votes more than two-thirds of the committee. So it was not particularly even that close when you just consider, you know, within politics, how hard it is to get two-thirds of people to agree on anything.
Right. Joe, was it surprising to you that he won the endorsement so early and, you know, so decisively?
Not really, because the makeup of that committee is very much behind President Trump and his policies. So they have tended to endorse conservative candidates as part of that. So I wasn't surprised that he got the endorsement. But I was kind of surprised that, you know, well, I think you're going into it, so I won't talk about it yet. But I'm surprised that we have not heard anything yet from Jim Trussell as far as entering the race.
Okay. Well, before we get to Jim Trussell, at the time of this endorsement, Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost was running for governor, too. Joe, when did he drop out of the race?
He dropped out last Friday, and basically he said, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy and Dave Yost, he said, we have a lot of the same goals, ideas, and I'm just not worth having this big, you know, fight. I will, you know, support Vivek. And he dropped out via basically a press release.
Huh. So, Andrew, did he endorse Ramaswamy?
He hasn't done that yet, but I think it's kind of, you know, he basically said that the differences between us aren't that great. We need to get unified. So I'd have to look to see if he uttered the magic words, I endorse Vivek Ramaswamy. It's often, you know, a lot of divining has to take place to kind of find the subtleties like that. But he made clear that, you know, he's on the same page and that he thinks the Republican Party needs to unite. And the way that he put it was that he actually referenced Sherrod Brown, the former senator, in his press release. So, you know, that's a whole other topic, whether or not that's going to happen, whether he will run for governor or not. But he said the prospect of a Sherrod Brown for governor is so great that we need to all rally around and as Republicans and, you know, get together.
Huh. Joe, you mentioned Lieutenant Governor Jim Trussell. Do you think he might enter the race?
Well, he is not ruling it out. Let's put it that way. And when he was asked about whether this endorsement by the Republican Party really would keep him from entering the race, he said, nah, he really doesn't give that, you know, that's not carrying much weight for him. He said, you know, he's basically weighing things right now, trying to figure out the lay of the land and learning a lot. And he doesn't see a sense of urgency to enter. He said eventually he'll have to make that decision, but he's certainly not talking about making that decision right now.
Joe, who else is running for governor from the Republican Party? There is another candidate running right now, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a candidate from Morgan County. Am I right, Andrew? Is it Morgan? It's a smaller county, and I can't remember
That's
her
right.
name.
Yep.
Yeah.
Heather Hill.
And she's a local player down there, but I can't remember her name right now. But she's not thought to be formidable against Vivek.
Andrew, I think you mentioned her name.
Yeah, it's Heather Hill. She's a former school board member from Morgan County. And if it says anything, she didn't even attend the Ohio Republican Party meeting to try to get the endorsement, which granted, maybe she didn't think she had a great chance. But, you know, she could have showed up. So it doesn't seem that she has a really strong, you know, campaign at this point.
Joe, what do you think Lieutenant Governor Tressel might have going for him as a candidate?
Well, you know, I think the first thing is he has name recognition. Everyone knows Jim Tressel. And he doesn't have any kind of big overlying controversial thing hanging above his head. I think that Governor DeWine has made some big changes. Like if you consider education health, he's made changes there, and it will take years to see the full impact of those changes. When you look at Vivek Ramaswamy, he's talking about efficiency and tax cuts, making Ohio great again, that kind of thing. And he could cut some of DeWine's programs right off the bat. And it might even be harder for Vivek Ramaswamy to sell that line in Ohio, given that Ohio's been under Republican control for most of the last 30 years. But anyway, when Yost dropped out, he said he agreed with Vivek Ramaswamy on most things. But Lieutenant Governor Tressel agrees with DeWine on a lot of things. And he can raise money quickly if he wants to. And he's got a lot of contacts out there. He has a more measured approach, and he will be more likely to keep DeWine's programs more intact.
And well known because he's a former Ohio State football coach who won a national championship for the state, right?
Exactly.
For the college.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Andrew, any thought? Do you think Governor Mike DeWine is pushing Jim Tressel to run, considering everything Joe just said?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that question. And I think the governor's being somewhat subtle, but not totally subtle. He did make some private calls right before the Ohio Republican Party meeting, pushing them to delay the endorsement. He didn't say, hey, you really need to support Jim Tressel. He was kind of more circumspect than that. But I think that the people who got those calls, whether it was from him or from his allies, read them that way. And then after the fact, he's kind of sticking to that. So yeah, if I just had to kind of interpret his actions, I believe he does want Tressel to run. But, you know, until he actually says that, all we can really do is just kind of guess.
Yeah. I want to ask you both this question, get thoughts from each of you. Joe, what do you think this early endorsement of Vivek Ramaswamy says about Mike DeWine's influence in Ohio's Republican Party right now? Do you think there's a message there?
There might be, you know, the fact that they came out over, you know, the objections of the governor, that's, you know, but it's not the first time that DeWine has had problems with people in his own party and disagreed with them. So I don't make a lot of it. And I think there's another thing here, too, and that is time. We have a lot of time yet before the gubernatorial primary. And so I think that this endorsement is getting out there early, and it's kind of capitalizing on the national kind of feel for the national MAGA candidates, kind of using, you know, President Trump's leadership and his endorsement of Vivek Ramaswamy. But, you know, a lot can happen in a year. And so, you know, We'll just have to see. I don't think that this endorsement is certainly the death knell for any candidate.
What do you think, Andrew? Do you think this endorsement has something to say about the Republican Party's relationship with Mike DeWine in Ohio these days?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in theory, the governor is the top Republican in the state, but we've seen times where he's pushed to try to get things that he wants, whether it's trying to get the legislature to you know, we've seen the legislature overturn his vetoes. We've seen the governor endorse candidates like Matt Dolan in the U.S. Senate race a couple of years ago, and then that candidate lose. So You know, his he's kind of a, you know, an old guard Republican. The party's changed a lot since he was first elected to office 40 years ago. So, I mean, it's not uncommon for any governor to lose their influence towards the end of their term. You know, people want to kind of like, you know, get on the rising star and not somebody who's kind of on their way out. But there's also kind of some ideological and kind of generational differences, too, like I said.
That old guard Republican idea. Governor DeWine has an interesting relationship with President Trump. How would you describe that relationship, Andrew?
Oh, I guess they're frenemies, maybe is the word that I would use. You know, we've seen Trump at times kind of blast DeWine. We've seen him in the past kind of suggest that maybe somebody should challenge him in a primary that ended up not coming to pass. So it's clear that, you know, they don't love each other. But DeWine's always, you know, I think he's very pragmatic. He wants to, you know, he says he supports Trump. He wants to have a good relationship with the administration. We've seen him recently bring in Trump's agriculture secretary, Brooke Rollins. You know, we saw one of DeWine's aides get a job for the US EPA. So they're not like at odds or anything like that exactly, but it's clear that there's not a lot of warmth between the two people and there's not a lot of trust.
Joe, do you think that lack of warmth could have anything to do with the kind of state party's relationship with DeWine right now?
Well, it could. I mean, I think DeWine has kind of that relationship with not just President Trump, but other hardliners in the party. I mean, you know, Governor DeWine has never been what I think a lot of people would consider a hardliner. He's always been more of a centrist, like Andrew said, a traditional Republican. And I think, you know, right now that, you know, even if he has differences with people in the party who are more conservative, like Andrew said, he's pragmatic. He knows how to get, you know, people in on the same page enough to get something done. And he oftentimes, you know, you look at his budget right now, his proposed budget is very different than what we see in the House and the Senate. But, you know, when the budget comes out of the House and the Senate, even if it's vastly different, he'll probably, you know, go for a lot of their ideas because he likes that idea of everyone having a seat at the table kind of thing.
We've talked a lot about the state Republican Party so far today, but I want to turn to the Democrats, and right now only one Democrat is running for governor. Joe, tell us about Dr. Amy Acton's candidacy.
Well, she's the former health director, and everyone may recognize her from the wine with DeWine days of COVID, when everyone was sitting around, you know, watching PBS Ohio Channel every day and trying to figure out what was happening in the state as the COVID pandemic moved through. Now, you know, she was very controversial back then. She, you know, operated as a doctor with the medical knowledge that she had at the time. You got to remember, COVID was new, so, you know, doctors didn't have a lot to work with. But she was making some changes and recommendations that a lot of the business community didn't like and a lot of Republicans didn't like. And still to this day, there are a lot of people who really do not like Dr. Amy Acton for the things that she did during COVID. I think that's how Ohioans know her best. And so she's going to have, you know, the love. Some people are going to love her because they're going to say she saved lives and she was great. And then other people are going to say, nope, never going there. Hmm.
Andrew, we kind of referenced this earlier, but there's been a lot of talk about either former Senator Sherrod Brown or former Congressman Tim Ryan entering the race to become the Democratic nominee. Do you think either one or both of them might jump in?
So I'll kind of take them in order. I'll start with Tim Ryan. I think that's a little simpler. He actually recently booked an appearance with I think it was the Champaign County Democratic Party. So it might seem like a small thing. You know, it's kind of the like the political circuit. But it's notable that he's out there doing stuff like that. He has something of a campaign sort of staff in place. It's not really official yet, but it's pretty clear that he's considering it. He's ruled out running for the U.S. Senate, for example, and that's another seat that Democrats are going to have to try to find somebody to run in. But I definitely think that Tim Ryan wants to see what Sherrod Brown is going to do. So, you know, Brown lost his office last November in the U.S. Senate. He'd been there for a long time. He's kind of the standard bearer for the Ohio Democratic Party. And Brown is kind of keeps his cards close, but kind of like talking to people in Democratic circles. I think there's a growing belief that he's going to run for office. It's kind of a toss up if that might be trying to get back into the U.S. Senate, where Ohio has a potential to factor into the bigger picture there about which party controls the Senate in next year's election, or the governor's race. I think there's actually probably some hope among segments of Democrats that he run for governor. I think he can have more of an impact in terms of leading the ticket and possibly either lifting up the candidates on the ballot, or at least not hurting them, like we've seen like we saw in 2022, which when DeWine was easily reelected. But Brown may well also just choose to just kind of serve out his retirement and be an advocate. So it's a question mark. But you know, the fact that there are Democrats looking at those two guys and wondering whether they may run, it does reflect that there's some measure of dissatisfaction with Acton and concern that maybe she'll be a weak candidate.
Well, looking ahead to the governor's race, President Trump carried Ohio by such a wide margin in the last presidential election. Does any Democrat have a chance in the governor's race? I mean, Joe, any thoughts on what the political climate could be like in next year when this race is on the ballot?
Oh, that is so, there are so many factors that go into that. I think, you know, if the economy goes south, if President Trump's tariffs start costing people a lot of money, if people start souring on a lot of the things that President Trump, does, a lot of things he says, a lot of the way he acts, then maybe there's an opening. But, you know, the other part of that is that Democrats really need, if they're going to capitalize on that, they really need to step up and, you know, fill that void with, some sort of message. And we have seen nationally that, you know, people like Bernie Sanders have been out there talking about, you know, what's going on nationally and how he would do it differently. But we haven't seen that kind of organized kind of effort in Ohio to give another sense of what's out there, another alternative. So there's not the message coming out in Ohio from the Democrats that there is nationally. And I think that's a key part of the piece. It's not just, the refusing Trump and maybe not buying into his policies, but people, they have to feel like there's another option. And so we'll see where that goes.
Anything you want to add to that, Andrew?
Yeah, I think Democrats are always going to have a chance in Ohio. I mean, I guess, unless things just drastically change. But the last time that Trump was in office and there was a midterm election, Rich Cordray ran against Mike DeWine that year. It was a very strong year for Democrats. And while DeWine won, it was a close race. So it's possible. And we saw, there's Democratic governors in Kentucky and Kansas, which is something that I always point out when you think about whether a Democrat can conceivably win in a state where you think of it as we do now with Ohio, but it's pretty red. But yeah, like Joe said, a lot of it comes down to the environment. It comes down to who's going to run. I mean, things have changed since back then. I think Trump has kind of consolidated support in his own party more since then. I think he's pulled along some crossover voters more than back then. So, you know, it's not like going to be a recreation of that election cycle or anything like that. But I both think it's possible for Democrats to eventually win one here. I think some of the areas that voted for Trump that maybe in the past voted for Democrats, I think there's evidence they remain, independent and not just, solid Republican votes. And so I think the ingredients are possibly there, but it just kind of all comes down ultimately, like Joe said, about the national environment where things are a year from now.
Okay, well, plenty to keep an eye on. I've been talking with Ohio Public Media, State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles, and Signal Ohio State Government and Politics reporter Andrew Tobias. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you, Lucy.
Happy to do it. Thanks a lot.
Up next, we'll hear about the preliminary autopsy results in the death of Ryan Hinton. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Hamilton County's coroner released preliminary autopsy results this week in the death of Ryan Hinton, an 18-year-old who was fatally shot by a Cincinnati police officer. Joining me now with the latest on this case is Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Cameron Knight. Welcome back, Cameron.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate your being here. We're going to get into these autopsy results, but first, remind us about the circumstances surrounding Ryan Hinton's death.
So on May 1st, there was a report of a stolen car. The report came out of Northern Kentucky. The owner or someone connected to the owner was tracking the car on like a built-in GPS unit. It was tracked to Cincinnati. The car was parked in the back of an apartment complex. So it was sort of a one way in, one way out sort of situation. Once they had like a location of the car, Cincinnati police responded with unmarked units. They drove up to examine the situation. The unmarked units noted that there were people in the car, so they backed out. And there has not been a great explanation about why that switch occurred. I assume that they probably didn't want to engage with anybody without having their uniforms and things on because people can get confused.
Sure.
Things can escalate. So they backed out. The unmarked units backed out. Marked units and uniformed officers came in. As they approached the car, there were four people in the car, and they all got out of the car and fled. The officers that were there sort of began chasing different people. As one of the people fled, Mr. Hinton fled. He fell and dropped what appeared to be a gun on the ground. As he was getting up, he grabbed that gun and according to the police, had it in his hand. He kept going away from the car, and he came through two dumpsters, in between two dumpsters, and there was an officer on the other side of those dumpsters who opened fire on him. Police say that he pointed the weapon. Other people said that it may have been in a bladed position. There's some controversy about kind of the positioning of everyone in the situation. And
it's unclear from the body cam video.
And the body camera video is shaky. It's not super clear. They have not, as far as I can tell, they have not released like everybody's body camera. There were, I think, five officers on the scene at the time. So there's a lot of body camera that could be probably reviewed. And there's all of this is under investigation by many different agencies at this time. Yeah. So
let me stop you and ask you a quick question, because this came in from a listener. There's this talk of Ryan Hinton having a gun, dropping the gun, having the gun in his hand. Have the police has anybody seen that gun? Have the police presented the evidence of that gun at any of these news conferences?
They have said that the gun has been recovered. Now they have not like held it up at a press conference or anything like that. As far as I know of, at the events I've been at, they have not showed it to anybody. To be fair to them, in the past, they've never done that before either. They've shown pictures of things and everything, but they don't like
hold up the weapon.
Hold it up or anything.
Yeah. What did the coroner say about Ryan Hinton's gunshot wounds?
So she said that there were three gunshot wounds, but that one, there were three gunshot wounds, but that two of those gunshot wounds could have been caused by the same bullet. So she did not talk about the order in which these gunshot wounds occurred. She didn't talk about the position of the body when the gunshots occurred. She was very clear that she just wanted to say there were three gunshot wounds. One of the gunshot wounds was to his arm. The other gunshot wound, which she said was the fatal gunshot wound, entered through the side of his body. It hit his ribs. It punctured his heart, and then it exited through near the sternum of his body. And she said that, you know, bullets can kind of curve and bounce around when they strike things like ribs. She also pointed out that the gunshot wound in the arm could have been the same bullet that went into his chest. So if you imagine when you're running, your forearm is in front of your ribs, and the bullet could pass through your forearm into your body. She also said that it could be separate bullets that struck his arm and his side, but she said that it could have been the same one. The last, not chronologically, because she did not talk about the order of this, but the third shot that she talked about was entered the right posterior, I'm so bad with medical terminology.
Oh, that's okay.
The right, basically, she said near the shoulder. She said the right posterior lateral chest, which I think kind of means like shoulder blade by the shoulder sort of area. That bullet entered around that area and came to rest kind of near the base of Ryan's skull, and that bullet was recovered. The other bullet that went through the arm and went through the chest, those were pass-through bullets, and I don't believe that bullet was recovered.
Did the coroner say anything else about the autopsy, like toxicology or anything like that?
So she said that there were tox screens that were performed. She said that there was something that showed up on the tox screen, and she did not want to go into the details of that. And she said that she said there are tests, which I'm assuming might be toxicology related or some kind of other related tests, that were still pending at the time of her press conference, which was earlier this week.
Now, I know the coroner had earlier planned to have this news conference last week. That got put off, I think, because she was subpoenaed by the prosecutor. What did Prosecutor Connie Pillage have to say about that subpoena? Why did that happen?
Well, her statement was that it was kind of standard procedure. That was basically, you know, there's different things that get subpoenaed for different reasons. I think that the interest in that portion of it comes from whether or not this case will be taken to a grand jury. No one has said one way or another whether the case, this shooting, this homicide, however you want to call it, will be taken to a grand jury or not. Historically, the past prosecutors in Hamilton County have very infrequently taken cases of police shootings to grand juries. And the only two that I know of are Stephen Roach, who shot Timothy Thomas in 2001, and Ray Tenzing, who shot Sam DeBose near UC. He was a UCPD officer, and that was in like 2015. And the charge for Stephen Roach was, I think, negligent or reckless homicide, one of those two, which is like a misdemeanor charge. And then Tenzing was charged with murder. But there are other places, like Butler County, their county prosecutor takes every single police shooting to a grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been interesting with Connie Pillage being a new prosecutor, trying to figure out and see her kind of figure out how she wants to approach each of these situations and whether, she's already had some officers involved shootings where she has said that the officer didn't do anything wrong and that she wasn't going to take it to a grand jury because mm-hmm. she just made the determination herself. So it will be interesting to see how a new administration in the prosecutor's office handles these things moving forward.
How has the Hinton family responded to what the coroner had to say?
They said that there were some inconsistencies between what the coroner said and what was initially said by the police chief after the shooting. The police chief, I think, mentioned that he was struck twice, once in the arm and once in the side or once in the chest. I don't exactly remember what exactly she said, but they said there were some discrepancies between both accounts. Those statements that Thiege made, Chief Thiege, were made very early on.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously this was after an entire autopsy, the things that Samarco said. So we have a gap in time. And they've also said that they're conducting their own investigation. They have sort of said that, they don't want to see this situation used by the politicians to kind of jockey for attention or anything. And they've just been, saying we want information from all the parties involved. And after the coroner put out her press release and held her press conference, they said that their lawyer is still awaiting information from both the coroner's office and the police department for them to continue their investigation.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, but I do want to ask you about Ryan Hinton's father. He's in custody. He's accused of killing a sheriff's deputy. Prosecutors say that he killed that deputy after being very distraught, seeing the body cam footage of his son being fatally shot by police. Rodney Hinton Jr., who is Ryan Hinton's father, has been getting support on an online fundraising platform. Can you tell us briefly about what's going on there?
Yeah, so there's all these crowdfunding websites. You've probably heard of GoFundMe is sort of like the big one. They've become kind of the Kleenex brand of this sphere. But there's a lot of other ones. And there's one who has continued to have a fundraiser up for Rodney Hinton Jr. And it's sort of not perfectly clear like what they're trying to raise money for, but it, you know, there are implications it could be used for his legal defense or something like that. There's a law in Ohio called the Son of Sam Law, which was created because someone wanted to kind of sell their story after they had done some horrific crime. And there's a law barring people from kind of selling their story based on a violent crime. And David Yost came down to town, the Ohio Attorney General. He came down to town to kind of talk about this, and he denounced it. He said that the policies of these crowdfunding sites sort of universally say this shouldn't happen. And he said that there is no current state law that would allow them to go after these crowdfunding sites. But he really is encouraging the legislature to create a new law so that they can.
Mm-hmm. And the crowdfunding sites, they get a cut of the money they raise.
Typically, yes.
Typically, okay. What has the Hinton family responded to this fundraising aspect at all?
As far as I know, they have not. Mm-hmm. They are really focused, at least through their communications with their lawyer. They are very, very focused on Ryan Hinton and what happened to him involving the Cincinnati police officer, and that he was shot and he was killed and he was only 18. That's their message mm-hmm. that they're trying to really stick to.
Yeah. A lot going on with that family for sure. I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Cameron Knight. Thanks so much for your time today, Cameron, and for your reporting.
Thank you.
Up next, the Brent Spence Bridge Project is really going to happen. I mean, really, really. This is Cincinnati Edition. Young people are seeing their dreams dashed by federal cuts, and local nurses are taking up protest signs. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about the local impact of Trump administration cuts is Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Patricia Gallagher Newberry. Welcome back, Patty.
Hi, Lucy.
Thanks for being with us. You recently looked into how many young people in Greater Cincinnati are feeling the effects of these federal government cuts. How many young people are we talking about?
Well, the best I can say is hundreds of the examples that I put together. It's very difficult to have a definitive number, but a handful of different programs are losing federal dollars. AmeriCorps volunteers that were supported through the federal government, arts organizations, and similar kinds of groups. A lot of kind of smallish cuts in the scheme of things, but big cuts if you're a small agency.
Sure. And a lot of these examples were nonprofits. It sounds like this is a real big range of organizations, right?
Yeah. I mean, for example, Artworks, which Cincinnatians know is, a very important program for our young people aspiring to work in the arts, lost a significant grant that was going to support a project to put a mural and some outdoor sculptures along the Wasson Way Trail. They've lost that. That was a project that was 5 years in the making. It was $100,000. Yeah, that was from the National Endowment for the Arts, $100,000. They'd spent all these years ramping up to get it done. They'd even hired 10 employees who were going to be part of that. And that is essentially killed for the summer. They may, get some money back at some point in time, but that's, just one example among several that I was able to put together for this latest piece.
What other kinds of work were these young people doing?
In terms of AmeriCorps, which of course lost funding, widespread funding, I have an example of a couple of AmeriCorps workers who were helping the Kentucky Symphony Orchestra with their education programs. Mill Creek Alliance had a couple of AmeriCorps workers that went out into the community, told people about their priorities as a creek protection kind of agency, worked with school students. So they've lost that. A group called Breakthrough Cincinnati, they stage an annual program for young people, 5 weeks, about 200 local middle schoolers. They pick up these kids in the sixth grade. And then for the next 4 years, they stay with the program. They do this 5-week program. They come in and they learn about the college experience. So it's really a college-ready kind of program to get kids who might not think that they're going to make it to college, may not think they're going to be able to find the funds for college, you know, coach them through that whole process, encourage them, support them. And that program lost, that was $380,000 AmeriCorps. They're going to go forward with it, but, you know, now they're having to scramble to fill in those lost dollars with private funds. They may have to scale back. And then going forward, that's, you know, a lot of uncertainty going forward, whether they can do this program, at least in the same way that they have in the past.
And that's one organization that's going to replace those federal dollars with private donations or try to. Are all of them in that position? Can they easily, or I guess even potentially, replace the federal funds that they lost with donations from other places?
Well, I think they're all scrambling. That is a big question. What are they going to do to replace these dollars? The guy with Mill Creek Alliance said it very well. We're all fishing from the same pond. We're all out there asking our donor communities, our constituents, you know, can you do a little bit more for us? So yes, there's a mad scramble underway, and I'm reading this in other places as well, for nonprofits and any kind of group that's losing federal funding to reach out to their alternative sources, whether it's at the state level, or it's individual donors, or it's foundations that have supported them in the past, et cetera, and say, you know, we lost some dollars. What can you do to help us out?
How much warning did these organizations get that the cuts were coming?
Very little, from what I could tell. Most of them learned about these cuts, of course, just this spring, obviously, since the Trump administration took office in late January. But some of them were only learning about these cuts sometime in April or May.
How have these cuts been playing out at larger federal agencies? I'm thinking of the EPA and NIOSH locally.
As your listeners probably know, there are something like 14,000 federal workers in Greater Cincinnati. And early on, our reporting was mostly focused at what was going to happen to these larger agencies. So we have the EPA in Cincinnati has the large facility on Martin Luther King. Hard to know exactly how many people they employ, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 to 600. We have NIOSH with two different locations, a combined workforce of 400. And then most recently, I was reporting on the VA, the Veterans Affairs Hospital, which has a bunch of different locations, clinics, as well as a main hospital and a second hospital, and learned that they have 2,600 employees across Greater Cincinnati. So our larger agencies, most of them have been targeted for cuts, right? As the Trump administration, and particularly the Department of Government Efficiency, have announced various cuts. However, I would say, and I know your own reporters are finding this as well, there's a lot of uncertainty. Something is said by an official in Washington, a press release is put out by an official in Washington, the Trump administration issues an executive order, and there are clues sometimes to what's coming, but sometimes it's filtered through a lot of different layers, and what is actually reality on the ground is a bit difficult to find out. So, you know, I've been talking to a good number of union officials who are really the only ones are willing to talk at the local level. You cannot pick up a phone and talk to the head of the EPA operations or the NIOSH operations or the VA operations locally. The union officials even have a lack of clarity. They don't know exactly how many jobs they have. They don't know exactly how many people are in their buildings at any given time. You know, there have been announced layoffs or, you know, removed from work, and then people are called back. There's been a lot of legislation at the federal level that has pushed back on some of these cuts, and then courts order the Trump administration to restore jobs. And so it's really, it is a very fluid situation, as they say. It's really hard to know how many people are out of work at a given moment and how many might be restored at some future point.
You mentioned the VA here in Cincinnati. Tell us about the concerns there. What's happening?
Right. So yesterday they had a big rally outside the VA hospital in the Coryville area. It was staged by a group I was not familiar with, the National Nurses United Union. That group says there are 700 nurses employed by the VA across Cincinnati. And again, the VA has a main hospital, a hospital in Northern Kentucky, and then a number of clinics where people can go for care. So they staged a rally yesterday because, well, really for three distinct reasons. One, they are objecting to the Trump administration's plans to cut an alleged or reported 80,000 jobs across the country. That would be around 15%. So somewhere between 70,000 and 80,000 jobs across the country. So the nurses are afraid that they're going to lose jobs in Cincinnati that they believe are critical to the care of veterans. They also are concerned about their own jobs and their own schedules. One particular, for example, is that the VA administration apparently would like nurses to resume an 80-hour schedule every 2 weeks. They've been on a 72-hour schedule every 2 weeks. Apparently, a proposal is coming down the pike that they pick up 8 more hours. The nurses union does not support that. It's a demanding job, and they need to keep the people that they have and keep them happy and make sure that they're in tip-top shape to take care of the patients in the VA system.
What does the Trump administration say about why these cuts are needed at the VA?
In this case, the director of the VA has testified before Congress. He has put out some public statements. And the theme is the same for all of the agencies, that the Trump administration wants to cut jobs as a way to reduce overall expenses, to be more efficient, cut waste and fraud. Now, is there waste and fraud and lack of efficiency in these agencies? Well, no doubt, but in no instance have I seen has a Trump official or the head of a secretary of one of these departments actually spelled out in letter and verse, here is the list of inefficient practices. Here is our list of wasteful programs. You know, with the exception of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, which the Trump administration has just kind of broadly dismissed as unnecessary to the core mission of essentially any federal agency. So every executive order, every statement that comes out of Washington attached to a secretary of a department basically uses the same explanation that we're seeking efficiency, we're cutting waste, and we're getting rid of fraud in the system.
Patty, you also have an update on the Brent Spence Bridge project. So it's really going to happen?
That's my lead. It's really going to happen. It is moving along. And, you know, to tie this back to the Trump administration, on day one of the Trump administration, there was a hue and cry that went out because there was a memo about spending for infrastructure projects that made it sound like those were going to pause. And after about 24, 48 hours, there was clarity that no, the portion that was attached to the Brent Spence Bridge project was not going to pause. It was a different program that was going to pause. But we had a lot of hand-wringing there for a minute. So yes, the Brent Spence Bridge project has been in the works for more than 20 years. It's fully funded. $1.6 billion, B as in boy, comes from the feds. The rest comes from the state of Kentucky and the state of Ohio. It moved forward significantly during the Biden years because the Biden administration post-COVID put together some funding packages that were aimed at infrastructure funding. And so once that happened, things really started to speed up with the Brent Spence. And now they have a fully built out staff. They have a lead contractor. This year, they're doing about 6 different projects to clear the way to make way for the construction of a new bridge and the start of the reconfiguration of the existing bridge. So I've been reporting on this for about 3 years now, and there is just an awful lot of activity. But the one question that they cannot answer at this point that every reporter in town wants to know is, when is there a shovel in ground moment? When will there be an official groundbreaking? And that's not known yet. The best they're able to say at this point is late this year, early next year.
And just briefly review what the project will do. You mentioned the old bridge, the new bridge, and also what problem it's trying to solve.
Well, let's start with the last. The bridge was built in 1963 to accommodate roughly 80,000 vehicles a day. It is currently accommodating more than twice that on average. Every year is a little bit different, but that's the average. So 160 vehicles a day versus the 80 it was designed for.
160,000 versus 80,000?
Yes, yep. Exactly. Yep. Yes, yes. And at some point, the lanes on the existing bridge were expanded from 3 in each direction to 4 in each direction, leaving the shoulders on the existing Brent Spence at 1 foot on either side. And that's a very narrow shoulder, right? Anybody who's taken the bridge, you know, if there's an accident, it really snarls up traffic because there is nowhere to go to get off for safety. And so the project has several priorities. The new bridge will be built to the immediate west of the Brent Spence. It will be the interstate bridge. So it will carry 75 and 71 traffic over the Ohio River. It will have 2 decks like the existing bridge. There'll be 5 lanes in each direction on each deck. So that is 10 new lanes of traffic only for interstate. There will not be local exits from the new bridge. The new bridge doesn't have a name yet. It's just been called the Companion Bridge. That piece will be built first. The idea is we're going to build that first. And when that is complete, we'll be able to divert traffic from the existing Brent Spence, close that for the short time is needed to reconfigure that bridge and return it to 3 lanes on each deck in each direction. So a reduction on the number of the existing lanes on the existing bridge, but then you're picking up 10 lanes for interstate traffic on the new bridge. The existing will then become your conduit to local, you know, going into or out of Northern Kentucky, into out of Cincinnati, downtown Cincinnati.
Well, you mentioned $1.6 billion with a B dollars is coming from the feds. What's the total cost of this project?
$3.6 billion.
Well, I know you will continue to follow it. We'll be waiting to see when that shovel will hit the ground. And I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Patricia Gallagher Newberry. Thanks so much for your time today, Patty.
And thanks to you, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical directors are Marshall Verbsky and Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.